Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to convene the June 28th, 2017 meeting of the Subcommittee on Natural Resources for the Joint Ways and Means Committee. We have a fairly long agenda today, so we're going to try and get through each of the bills as expeditiously as possible. For those of you who will be testifying, we will greatly appreciate if you can just say me too if someone else has already stated your position. That'll help us move the agenda. With that, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 847. And Mr. Stainer, could you remind us what this bill's about, please?
Certainly, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 847 establishes a process by which the Department of State Lands and the Legislative Assembly may identify tracts of trust lands that have limited performance potential as assets to the Common School Fund, and then submit proposals to the Legislative Assembly for the transfer of those lands to another state agency, to a federal agency, or to a tribe. The bill also creates a fund, but provides no specified source of revenues for the fund. The LFO recommended amendment clarifies the property, the type of property valuation required, and also removes sections of the bill related to the fund, as the Department of State Land has existing funds within the state treasury that can be used for the purposes of the bill. So LFO recommends adoption of the Dash 1 amendment to the Senate Bill 847.
Thank you very much. Before I recognize Co-Chair Frederick, is everyone on board with where we're at here, moving towards the Dash 1? Very good. Co-Chair Frederick?
Chair Witt, I moved adoption of the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 847.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Frederick moves the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 847. Any questions on his motion? Discussion? Seeing none, hearing none. Is there any opposition to his motion? Again, seeing none, hearing none. Adopted. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, LFO recommends that Senate Bill 847, as amended by the Dash 1 amendment, be moved to the Ways and Means Full Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Not seeing anyone. Co-Chair Frederick.
Chair, when I move SB 847 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Frederick moves Senate Bill 847 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion or questions on his motion?
Not so much on the motion, but the physical on it. I'm seeing something.
Representative
it's a little strange.
On the physical, there's no bottom line here. It's a bunch of per acre for a 3-year period.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, I didn't have the printed copy in front of me, but the purpose of the fiscal in this statement, there is actually no fiscal impact statement, or there's no fiscal impact to the bill. The information that's provided in the fiscal impact statement describes what the current management costs to the Department of State Land for certain types of lands are, and to illustrate what those costs potentially would be to other state agencies would the transfer happen.
I see. Okay, thank you.
All right. Anyone else? I'm about to recognize Co-Chair Frederick. We all okay?
Okay.
Co-Chair Frederick, please. No, you've already
made
your motion.
Already made my
thank
motion.
You.
Thank you.
Will the clerk please call the roll?
Senator Girard?
Nope.
Aye. Senator Frederick?
Yes.
Representative Esquivel?
No.
Representative Helm?
Aye.
Representative Power?
Aye.
Representative Lewis?
No.
Representative Witt?
Aye. Having received the majority, the motion passes. And Carrier, Co-Chair Frederick?
That would be me.
And
for the House floor?
And on the House floor, I'm willing to do it. So,
okay.
Folks, if there are bills that any of you feel strongly about,
I'd be
jump in. You want to do that?
Yeah.
Representative Power would love to do this one.
Certainly.
So please don't hold back. Jump in. Thank you. Yes.
I feel strongly about, but I'm.
I understand that. I understand that, Senator Girard, and maybe next time. With that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 847. Thank you, subcommittee members. Now, we're going to do a public hearing and work session on House Bill 871. Good afternoon, Senator. Good afternoon. Welcome, please.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Colleagues, I'm Michael Denver. I represent District 23 in the Oregon Senate. That's Northeast and Southeast Portland. And I bring this bill before you, Senate Bill 871A, focusing on the Dash 6 amendments, which I'll speak to. This comes to you on a 5-0 vote from the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. My co-whatever on this was Representative Kenny Geyer, who's testifying elsewhere. She may come in midway.
Very good.
So this bill deals with the problem of residential demolitions when they're done improperly. And this will be familiar to some of you because we dealt with this partway a couple of years ago. Yes, great. The problem of when demolitions are not done properly, there is the potential for toxins that are in those residences, and there I'm talking primarily about lead and asbestos, getting into the air, flying around the neighborhood, getting into lawns, gardens, and you know, just into the air. And this is something that if it's a commercial building or industrial building, there are strict standards about making sure that doesn't happen. But for residences, we don't. And so a couple of years ago, this surfaced as an issue in our district. Representative Kenny Geyer and I share the same area. Came up in one of my constituent coffees, just real concerns about the effect of demolitions on the you know, the health of the neighbors. So at the time, we put together what came to be Senate Bill 705, which passed. It dealt exclusively with asbestos. We had wanted to do lead, but at the time there was a lack of clarity about which agency would oversee lead moving forward. And so we decided, okay, we'll just focus on asbestos here, and then during the interim do a work group on lead, which is what we did. Over the course of that work group, we realized that there was another problem that came about in the during the rulemaking on Senate Bill 705. We had assumed that the city, if it had an interest in this, would play a role in enforcement and education and et cetera. But it turned out that that the statute didn't allow that the way that we had passed it. You know, you had a situation where everything was put on DEQ to do the enforcement, but that was very awkward and not really something that DEQ was prepared, really had the capacity to do. You know, I think everyone involved agreed that really would be best if we could put more of this work onto the cities if they were so interested. And so, you know, the work group that ultimately came to what we have here in the Dash 6 amendments included my vice chair from the Environment Committee, Alan Olson, who's himself a contractor, the Home Builders Association, Building Codes, the Health Authority, DEQ, City of Portland. And what you have here is a program where, you know, a city may establish by ordinance a program for the demolition of residential residences or residential buildings. If they do have an ordinance, then they have to do certain things. One is that the person doing the work has to be certified. There's an existing lead certification program for remodeling. This is one of those oddities. If you're remodeling, you have to do certain things. You have to be trained to deal with lead or asbestos. But if it's a demolition, you don't. So this would require that the person doing the demolition would, go through that training program. And I will just point out for whoever, hopefully you'll pass this this amendment and it will become engrossed into the bill. And if you do so, you'll notice the change on the problem on line 15, where instead of talking about lead-based paint activities, it talks about lead-based pain activities. Now, this does cause pain in some ways, but I think there's a missing T here. So that's the first requirement. The second requirement is that the health authority is going to be developing a set of best practices which cities can then take advantage of. And those are the two major components. There are some other elements. But I should say, that's right, those best practices need to be, they will be developed by the health authority in consultation with DEQ, the Construction Contractors Board, and other stakeholders, including the home builders. So that is, in a nutshell, what the amendments do. The bill, as I understand it, has a very minimal fiscal to it. And, I just in closing want to thank Mark Mayer for drafting this so clearly. This was one of his last bills, I think, that he drafted. I think if you read this, it actually makes sense, and you can follow the program. And as well as all the stakeholders, Scott Berry, Mark Long from the Building Codes, and especially my legislative assistant, Elizabeth Swartaw, who started working on this when she was a PCC intern for me a couple of years ago, and now she's my second legislative assistant. Happy to answer any questions after you hear from my good colleague.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Alyssa Kinnegar from House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland, and I'm supposed to be over on another bill, so I'm just going to add, I think Michael covered it really well. I just want to also note notification of neighbors is another piece of this legislation. It's really important. Community members can advocate with the city instead of trying to figure out which agency to go to. So this is really a product of many months, probably a couple of years, really, on the heels of the last legislation that we did regarding demolitions and asbestos, to really continue to make sure that there's proper notification, that we have best practices. We looked at a lot of different places like the city of Baltimore that's doing really good work in this area. And I want to also thank all the stakeholders, Erica Hoover and Jen Corbridge, my staff, who also worked on this. I'm really pleased that it's gotten to this place and delighted to work with my good senator on it.
Thank you very much. Subcommittee members, any questions or comments for our colleagues? A very important bill. Thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Certainly appreciate that. I'd like to call up, please, Dan Eisenbees and Nancy Thorington, please. Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, members of the committee. For the record, Dan Eisenbees with the City of Portland, here today with Nancy Thorington from the City's Bureau of Development Services, happy to speak in support of Senate Bill 871 with the proposed Dash 6 amendments. The City of Portland, as Nancy can speak to, certainly hears from neighbors who have concerns about air quality issues associated with dust and potentially toxic materials from residential demolitions that are occurring in the city. Our support for this bill is based on it providing a framework for better integrating the city's permitting program for residential demolitions with the state regulatory framework for asbestos and lead-based paint dust. It is really about addressing those air quality concerns, not about taking a position on demolitions per se. We very much appreciate the leadership of Senator Dumbro and Rep. Kenny Geyer as well as the other sponsors of the bill and the work of all the stakeholders, including the state agencies and industry. Happy to address any questions, and Nancy can speak in more detail to the city's program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Witt and Co-Chair Frederick. Nancy Thorington, I'm a code and policy analyst with the City of Portland, and I've been working for several years with stakeholders, particularly our Development Review Advisory Committee, on demolitions, and the issue of the hazardous materials, specifically asbestos and lead-based paint, comes up consistently. So, you know, it's been very frustrating for us because there haven't been any regulations in place or any authority for us on some of these issues. And we've been working with the senator and the congresswoman Representative Geyer on this issue for the last several years, and we really appreciate the fact that this does give a lot of flexibility to the local jurisdictions. Specifically with the best practices for the lead-based paint, we can adopt whatever menu of best practices that the Oregon Health Authority comes up with, and that will allow us to tailor it to our needs, because obviously Portland's is going to be different, say, from, you know, Pendleton in terms of the impact. So we support this bill as written with the Dash 6 amendments, and any questions I would be happy to answer.
Thank you very much. Subcommittee members, do we have any experience with the do-it-yourselfer home demo person? Is there a set of best practices under the bill or the amendments that they would be required to follow?
Well, it gives the local jurisdictions flexibility in which ones they adopt and who it applies to. So, you know, assuming that the local government agency and the council adopts the practices that would apply across the board to whoever, regardless of whether they're a home builder or a contractor or a do-it-yourself, or the impacts are the same regardless of which way. Yeah.
All right. Very good. Anyone else? Thank you both very, very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up, please, Brett Sherry and Scott Barry.
Sherry and Barry, huh?
Yes. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon. Scott Barry on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association, and I would like to open with some thanks to Senator Dembro for the process he put together in getting this bill moved forward. I think it was important to us to make sure that the bill was not another tool for neighbors who didn't want already upzoned property to not be demolished, and that upzoned property redeveloped to a higher density. I think that was one of the concerns that we had coming into this. I think we worked through those issues to make sure that was not the issue. We sometimes do run into that where our preference is that the fight over whether higher density goes into a neighborhood occurs when that property is upzoned, not when the construction is going to start or the demolition. I think that our contractors were dealing with asbestos and lead on the job site. They're required to under OSHA, and so those folks are protected. But as you get out to the neighbors, it's hard to knock on the next door neighbor's door and make them put on the suit for lead and asbestos protection. So I think there is some important issues that are being addressed here. And with that, I know I signed up as both neutral and in favor, but the neutral part is probably where the association is. The in favor part is to show support for Senator Dembro and all the work he's put in to make this thing, I think, something that will work on the ground.
Very good. Thanks. Thank you.
Co-chairs Frederick and Witt. My name is Brett Sherry. I work with the Oregon Health Authority. I manage two different lead programs, the lead-based paint program as well as the childhood lead poisoning prevention program. So just going to talk a little bit about the health effects. Lead is a toxic metal that can affect nearly every system in the body. Obviously, children are more prone to this type of exposure. Children's bodies are still developing. They actually will absorb more lead than adults will. And they tend to explore the world with their hands and put their hands in their mouth. So all of this kind of leads up to having a bigger impact for children. So in Oregon, the leading cause of lead poisoning in children is actually exposure to lead-based paint. So we know that this is a concern. This is obviously an issue for my group. So it was mentioned briefly before, there are some loopholes in the regulations right now. If a contractor were to go out and disturb about 6 square feet of the outside of a house, they would have to be certified, licensed, and follow specific work practice standards. Where if they went out, that same contractor, and knocked the whole house down, there are no requirements to control that lead. So we've known about this loophole for a while. We basically follow the Code of Federal Regulations coming down from the Environmental Protection Agency. EPA's regs don't cover whole house demolitions. So we do get calls from concerned neighbors, especially about what's happening, how do I protect my garden, and what are you doing to prevent this? So we're actually really excited to work on some best practices to share with folks to you know, inform on how to prevent that lead from leaving, and to work with the cities that adopted the ordinance. Most of the other information I had to talk about was already talked about today, so I won't take too much time from everybody. So if there's any questions, just let me know.
Thank you very much. Are there any from the subcommittee? I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Anyone else from the public who wishes to testify today on House Bill? Should that be Senate Bill?
Senate Bill.
Senate Bill 871. Anyone at all? I'm going to close the public hearing. I opened a work session before. We're now in work session.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Members of the subcommittee, as alluded to in the testimony, the A6 amendments replace the text of the bill. The measure, as amended by the A6 amendments, allow for a city to establish a program for the demolition of residences or residential buildings, sets forth a number of requirements for persons performing a demolition, including methods for dealing with lead paint structures built before 1978. The measure also allows for the program established by the city to require the submission of an asbestos survey and notice of performance of activities to related to asbestos abatement before performing the demolition. LFO recommends the adoption of the A6 amendment.
Thank you. Subcommittee members, anything for Mr. Stainer before I recognize Co-Chair Frederick? Seeing none, Co-Chair Frederick.
Chair Witt, I move adoption of the A6 amendment to Senate Bill 871.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Frederick moves the A6 amendments to Senate Bill 871. Any questions or discussion on his motion? Any objections to his motion? Motion passes. Thank you, subcommittee members.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, LFO recommends that Senate Bill 871, as amended by the A6 amendment, be moved to the Ways and Means full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Frederick?
Chair Witt, I move Senate Bill 871, as amended, to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Co-Chair Frederick moves Senate Bill 871 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, questions on his motion? Yes, Senator Girard, please.
My name is Co-Chair. I'm going to be a no, but just to put it out there. But in this, I just need to do a little bit more research on my own, and I might change to a yes.
Very good. Appreciate that. Anyone else?
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
please. I would be a yes at this point, but I need to do a little more research in depth on this.
Okay.
Because, you know, I can see, I remember when we went overboard with lead-based paint on housing that was painted. I mean, it got to the point where you ended up with a three-ring circus tent around the property. Yeah. And, you know, everyone, it got pretty complex, so I'll just have to work with the Home Builders Association, and obviously they're okay with it, so I'll be okay with it at this point.
All right, appreciate that very much. Anyone else? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Senator Girard?
No.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Senator Frederick?
Yes.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Helm?
Aye.
Representative Power?
Aye.
Representative Lewis?
Aye.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes and carriers. Co-Chair Frederick. And who else wants to jump out on this one?
I wouldn't unless I changed my mind.
unless you go rogue here.
Exactly. Exactly. I would volunteer, but I can't now.
Representative Power. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. All right. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 871 and open a public hearing. Do we have any members here? No. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3427.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, House Bill 3427 requires owners or operators of a dam with a high hazard rating to develop an emergency action plan and file that emergency action plan with the Office of Emergency Management and local emergency service agencies. The bill does not apply to dams regulated under a dam safety program of a federal agency. Oregon currently has 75 state-regulated high-hazard dams, 58 of those have emergency action plans, only 13 have, and 13 of those have early warning systems. High-hazard dams are those where loss of human life is expected should the dam fail. Senate Bill 5542, the budget bill for the Water Resources Department included authorization to establish a permanent full-time engineer position that had been a limited duration position in the prior biennium to support the existing inspection workload and the additional inspection workload anticipated from the passage of House Bill 3427. The position is funded from dam inspection fees and monies from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. There is a fiscal impact associated with the bill, but that was already addressed in the agency's budget bill, as I stated.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Any opening questions of Mr. Stainer? Yes, Representative Lewis, please.
If I can.
Wherever you're most comfortable.
The other day. I can do it here. Chair Frederick, co-chair with members of the committee. For the record, Rick Lewis. I'm district representative for House District 18, portions of Marion and Clackamas County. This bill, several months ago, actually early in the session, in the Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee, we had a discussion with Water Resources Department about dam safety. And during that discussion, I asked the question whether or not high-hazard dams are required to have an emergency action plan. And the response was somewhat of a surprise to me that new dams that are under construction that are classified as high hazard are required to have one, but the older dams are encouraged to have one. And as a result of that, I had some discussions with Water Resources and put together this bill. You may note on there that it has good bipartisan support. This bill came before the Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee in the House side and passed out of there with a unanimous due pass recommendation. The concern really is around the high hazard dams, which are not unsafe dams. They just are dams that have the potential, due to their location, if there's a catastrophic failure, could result in loss of human life downstream from the dams. So there are a couple of things that are really important in this bill. One is the requirement that all high hazard dams have an emergency action plan. That excludes the federal dams, which are regulated federally, and they all meet all these requirements, so they're excluded from this bill. But the other thing is that many times these emergency action plans are developed, but they're not shared with county emergency management officials or with Oregon Emergency Management, possibly with Water Resources, although Water Resources does the inspections on the dams. So this bill also requires that when those plans are developed, they be shared with those agencies. And it also has a requirement that there be a periodic exercise. It doesn't need to be a full functional exercise, even a tabletop or something of that nature, to test the plan and make sure that all first responders are on board with what their responsibilities would be in the event of a catastrophic failure. So it provides a little bit more protection than what we've got right now. It doesn't go so far as to require an early warning system or any of that type of thing, although most of the dams currently have that. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Anything for our colleague? Well, Representative Lewis, thank you very much for bringing this very important bill forward.
Thank you.
With that, like to invite up, please, Peggy Lynch. Welcome, Peggy.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. First of all, I want to thank Representative Lewis for bringing this bill forward. The League is very concerned about the public safety and worked with the Water Resources Department well before the Oroville Dam disaster that you all have read about, and encouraged and was pleased to see that Package 102 was added to the Water Resources Department, first in the governor's budget, and then that you all have adopted Package 102, which provides for a permanent, not a limited duration, dam safety engineer. We still only have one in the state, and we have a number of dams, and you heard from the representative that the number is relatively large. But what this bill does is provide the planning part and a requirement that planning actually happen related to these dams. So for that, a good bill should pass. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I'm really pleased to see that we're going to continue to help the public safety.
Thank you. Anything for the witness? Thank you, Peggy, very much.
Thanks for your time.
Anyone else from the public desiring to testify on House Bill 3427 this afternoon? Last and final call. Going to close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3427. Mr. Stainer?
Mr. Chairman of the Subcommittee, we don't have any proposed amendments in front of us for 3427, so we're just looking for a motion to move the bill to the full Ways and Means Committee.
Very good. Thank you. Co-Chair Frederick.
Chair Witt, I'll make that motion to move House Bill 3427 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Frederick moves House Bill 3427 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, are there any objections to his motion? Thank you, subcommittee members. It passes. Co-Chair Frederick.
Yes. That was the full.
That was the full bore, wasn't it?
Yes.
Thank you. I didn't call the roll.
Well, you don't have to.
I don't have to. Okay. Carriers.
Carriers.
First off,
carriers?
Yeah.
Representative Lewis and Senator Girard.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you, subcommittee members. I'm going to close the work session. Hold on.
Discuss the problems here.
Ah, whether I needed to.
That's a good point.
I'm totally legal, totally constitutional.
Sure you are.
Totally just fine. Thank you. Thank you for checking on that too, Matt. Close the work session on House Bill 3427. Going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3249. Mr. Stainer?
I'm going to actually switch out with you, sir. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, thank you very much. And we'll
thank
see you.
All right. Good afternoon.
Hello. Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee, House Bill 3249 establishes the Oregon Agricultural Heritage Commission and the Oregon Agricultural Heritage Fund and directs the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board to establish programs that provide grants to owners of working land for succession planning, conservation management planning, covenants, and easements. Additionally, the measure requires the Legislative Policy and Research Office to study financial incentives, incremental tax reduction, and tax elimination regarding land transfer and succession planning for working land, and report the findings by September 15, 2018. The measure is anticipated to have a minimal fiscal impact to the Legislative Policy and Research Office for the study. We also have a proposed -2 amendment, which includes $190,000 of general fund appropriated to OWEB to carry out the provisions of the bill.
Thank you very much. Bear with me for a moment here, folks. Um, All right. With that, I'd like to call forward, please, Kelly Beamer and Nellie McAdams. Jerome, if you want to come up, that's fine.
Yeah.
They were supposed to sign me up. So I guess.
All right. You're you're signed up. We were just going to put the spotlight on you afterwards.
You brought in the JB team.
All right. Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kelly Beamer. I'm the executive director of the Coalition of Oregon Land Trusts. We're a statewide group that represents 19 individual nonprofit local organizations that help work with private landowners to conserve land. And COLT is part of a very diverse and unique coalition that has come together in Oregon that represents six statewide groups that work directly with landowners and two landowners as well. This coalition includes COLT, the Oregon Farm Bureau, the Nature Conservancy, Oregon Cattlemen's Association, Sustainable Northwest, and the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. So needless to say, this is definitely a unique opportunity to get direct landowner input. We came together to talk about two major issues. One is, how do we protect Oregon's farms and ranches? Number two, how do we protect the incredible fish and wildlife habitat that exists on that inventory of private working lands in Oregon? We believe the Oregon Ag Heritage Program is a very important program for Oregon right now because we are in the middle of a land crisis. 75% of our farms and ranches are going to be changing hands in the next 20 years. That's 10 million acres. And a lot of those lands also protect our most valuable fish and wildlife habitat. So if we are going to meet our state's overarching natural resource goals, our Oregon Conservation Plan, we need all the tools in the toolbox we can get. And so this coalition developed this program working together for the last 2 years. It does three major things. It prevents the conversion and fragmentation of farm and ranch lands in Oregon. It supports private landowners with voluntary tools that allow conservation partners and landowners to manage fish and wildlife on their land. And it also supports succession planning on farm and ranch lands in Oregon. I'd love to just share a quote from Doug Kramer, who is the state's largest blueberry farmer, who's also a part of our coalition, who summed it up well, saying, Oregon's agriculture and conservation communities need each other if we are going to address these emerging issues in the state. This is an incredible opportunity for us to come together and address both our working lands needs, the economies they support, the cultural fabric that they create, as well as the outstanding fish and wildlife habitat we have on those lands.
Thank you.
Co-chairs Witt and Fedrick, my name is Jerome Rosa, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Beef is Oregon's largest agricultural commodity at over $900 million a year for the last 3 years, and we represent over 10,000 ranchers across the state. To me, this bill is about passing farms and ranches on to the next generation. To others, this is about developing tools for landscape conservation. The tools in this bill are not for everyone, but they exist today in one form or another. So among the ways we wish to level the playing field for Oregon producers, here I'm referring to the non-federal match required by some NRCS programs. Currently, this is a problem in Oregon. Also, keep in mind, these tools are voluntary. This has been a very long, and I could attest, long and well-vetted process by this group. At over 2 years, we've been working together on this. We've had weekly meetings for over a year on this whole process. An unusual coalition, I think all of you would probably agree. Also, California and Washington have long-standing farm and ranch land preservation programs, and it's unfortunate that Oregon has never gotten there, and we're trying to do something about that. Hopefully, Oregon will someday address its taxation issues. I certainly hope when this happens, estate taxes go away. They're very problematic for high asset, low liquidity entities that make up agriculture. This is seed money, and it's a first step. Thanks for the opportunity, and please support House Bill 3249.
Thank you, Jerome.
And co-chairs Witt and Frederick and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. My name is Nellie McAdams, and I represent the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts. And in that role, I got to participate in the work group that developed this bill. It was, as Jerome said, a very long process that included seven listening sessions around the state and numerous opportunities for landowners and organizations with diverse perspectives to weigh in on the program. I also completed another tour of the state doing farm succession workshops. I did 38 of them around the state, and the rooms were packed. I talked to about 1,000 different farmers and ranchers, and they were hungry for this information. As Kelly said, most of Oregon's agricultural land, 10 million acres, is going to be changing hands in 20 years, but 80% of those farmers and ranchers probably do not have a thorough succession plan. Now, farm businesses are unique and probably have more difficulties coming up with a plan than most other businesses. It's not, the land isn't just a business, but it's a home, it's a natural resource, it's an heirloom that means a lot of things to different people, and farmers and ranchers are notoriously shy about talking about their emotions and financials with their family. So this is an important thing to support succession planning. This bill does not support one-on-one private succession plans with those farmers and ranchers. It just supports ties to the land, curriculum, and workshops. Those workshops I have seen really send farmers to their attorneys and CPAs to actually create the plan. This bill also creates a number of public benefits. Those include supporting the land base of Oregon's second largest economic driver and the primary economic driver in rural Oregon. It also helps to preserve the long-term investments in conservation by groups like Soil and Water Conservation Districts, OWEB, NRCS, and private funders. If that land is developed, then those conservation benefits disappear and that money has been at least partially wasted. And if that land is fragmented, it becomes a lot harder to preserve it on a landscape-wide scale. And as Jerome said, it brings in federal dollars, which Oregon has been leaving on the table. I should say, too, that the bill includes a provision that the rules for the grant programs will be as compatible as possible with federal working lands easement programs. That is the Agricultural Conservation Easement Program, which has extensive regulations about preserving agricultural and conservation values. Lastly, I would say that this bill, there's an urgent need for this bill. We've spent a long time developing it. The rulemaking process will need to be long as well because we'll have to include a lot of stakeholder involvement. So having the biennium for that process will be useful to the group. And lastly, we're losing farms and farmers as we speak. Each session, we are losing opportunities. So I urge you to pass the bill in this session. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel, Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're taking taxpayer money, giving it to a landowner, and then we're having an easement on the property. There's certain restrictions. Now, you said everything's voluntary here, except maybe the taxpayer didn't volunteer to participate in this. Who determined that we're going to take public money and do this?
Can I address that, Kelly, or do you
want? Well, I think what's before you today is the process of setting up the structure. Yeah. And so it really, it's to help set the table to really bring as many folks as we can to this process. And it's really creating the commission and creating that fund that can potentially receive private funding. And, you know, there's a lot of creative solutions. So the commitment really is about.
Please.
Yeah.
Okay. Understand that. The other thing that I saw when I went to one of these, it was the C2 Ranch in Southern Oregon, the public didn't have access to it. We're expending public dollars onto an easement onto private property, but we don't allow the public to go onto there. Is that correct?
I can speak briefly. The easements are made in partnership with the private landowner, so they are made to tailor the private landowner's needs. And some landowners, for example, open their land up for hunting on certain conditions. And those public benefits are really about, in the C2 Ranch case, the water quality provided to the community that is on that land. And also that ranching infrastructure in Southern Oregon is a 10,000-acre ranch that is continuing to operate, and the impact that has on the community and that infrastructure. So it's not each easement is really tailored to the needs of that landowner, and it's not always the case that there's no public access.
No. You've been to the C2 Ranch?
Yeah, we were partners putting on that tour.
It was, remember, they were irrigating from a ditch up above with flood irrigation. Is that the water quality we're talking about?
The easements are on the high land. In that particular instance, they're protecting the forest land where the water source is. And so it does flow into a nearby watershed.
It's an irrigation district.
Community.
Nellie, did you want to jump in?
Sure. Representative Esquivel, just a couple follow-up points. While not all easements do allow for public access, often public access is detrimental to the agricultural operation. Also, the public benefits that the public receives doesn't necessarily need to include access. It supports our agricultural industries. It supports rural communities that are able to benefit from these programs, and it supports the conservation that all of our public benefit from as well. It's also a way for a lot of these landowners to become introduced to other conservation programs through the land trust or through the soil and water conservation district that they get to work with, so for water improvement efforts as well.
Follow up,
please.
Okay, but see, my concern is you had a 10,000-acre ranch here. You had an area that they were growing, they were irrigating for cattle to be on, which is fine, I understand that. But the whole side of the mountain and around the side of the mountain was all timbered, and yet I believe there was no public access to that land. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think that, again, it's going to depend on the management plan.
I'm talking
plan.
About the C2 now. Was there public access to the C2 ranch?
Well, we'll have to get back to that. I don't know specifically. I mean, maybe Jerome, you can.
Yeah, Rep. Esquivel, my concern with your point here is we can make that reasoning for all NRCS dollars. All NRCS dollars that go out to the ranches doesn't automatically make them public access dollars. And the public is paying for those dollars. I have a tax assessment in Marion County that we pay, that we increased. And a large percentage of the ranches and the farms in that county get that. And it doesn't give them public access to our properties by getting that money.
Please.
Okay. The C2 ranch was the reason it was set aside, according to the individuals on the tour we went on, was because they were afraid that it would end up as a subdivision, you know, be developed. What is that? Closest town to that's maybe 7 or 8 miles. And it's a small town. It's the town of Eagle Point or Shady Cove. It's in between those two. Or Butte Falls. That's not gonna happen, and I have apprehensions about what I've been told on the C2 ranch.
Representative Esquivel, I have an example that I lived in Clackamas County on this exact issue. My son is 25. We went through a 2-year period of time where he was going to buy 110 acres of agricultural land that had been deemed to be developed at a really, really high cost. He was willing to buy that land. We went through a 1-year escrow period. And the day before we closed escrow after this 3-year period, he said, "Dad, I'm not going to do it. It's just too much risk," which he was smart for doing that. Price of wheat went from, which he was going to transition from $8 to $4. But the reason why he didn't was we were told that there was going to be an opportunity for a conservation easement on this land. And if he would guarantee for the next 30 years he would not develop that land, then he would get X amount of dollars that would make it doable to be able to buy that land and keep it in agricultural production, which was very divisive in the area. But the program wasn't in place. We worked with NRCS for over a year on the program, and they said, "Yeah, we feel like we can do this. Yeah, we feel Oregon will get there. Yeah, we've seen this work successfully in other states. We want to see it work here in Oregon." But he wasn't willing to take that risk. And so now he's in Texas, he's in the finance industry, And he's just, land cost is too high for these young people. And this is an opportunity for these land people, these young people who want to keep this land in agricultural production. And we're willing to sell off those development rights to be able to do that. And that's from home.
Other questions or comments? Nellie, you you mentioned in your testimony the immediate need for this bill. And Jerome has already described, I think, one land use public benefit that's served here. Could any of you describe a public benefit that would inure from conservation and the avoidance of fragmented lands?
Yeah, I'm happy to take a first crack at that. I was a participant in the Oregon Conservation Strategy and creating that with in partnership with ODFW as a stakeholder. And when you look at the conservation opportunity areas, which is really the specific places in our state where we have threatened fish and wildlife habitat, and you overlay that with EFU land or land grazed for zoning, you see a powerful visual, which is a lot of the work that we have to do to keep species from being listed is on private land. A great example is on a ranch in Wallowa County, you know, a century ranch, the Wolf Ranch, that's at the confluence of the Lostine and Wallowa River, where there's a historic salmon run. And the Nez Perce tribe has been working for a long time trying to restore that run. Because that land is under one contiguous ownership, that tribe is able to do a very robust management plan in partnership with that landowner to work to restore to that historic run. The tribal council's strongly supportive of this program because they've seen the benefits of being able to work with that one landowner along that critical 3-mile stretch. If you had subdivided that into 160 acres, you'd be working with dozens, perhaps, of landowners. So that's one specific public benefit to our fish and wildlife habitat.
If I may add a corollary to agricultural productivity in terms of that fragmentation, if you're going to run a successful ranch in eastern Oregon, you're going to need at least 10,000 acres. If for a ranch like that, fragmentation of even 2,000 acres, maybe your hay pasture or your winter pasture, is detrimental or devastating to that business and can absolutely destroy that business. So even though the fragmentation might be on a larger scale, you might not think that 160 or 320 acres is going to cause a lot of damage to the landscape, but it does make it almost impossible to piece together a viable operation, especially over time, and especially if even one house is put on that acreage and you have to run your cattle around their parameters. It can create a lot of conflict.
Thank you. Now, it might be argued by some that succession planning is, in essence, we're planning on passing property to the next generation, whoever that might be, and that would properly be a function of estate planning. What does this bill offer that estate planning perhaps doesn't on an individualized basis?
Sure. With estate planning, especially in the unplanned estate, but in a lot of farm and ranch estates, they're land rich and cash poor. And so they often have to liquidate some of their farm or ranch assets in order to pay estate tax, in order to pay attorney's fees, in order to pay back the kids who aren't going to come back to the farm or ranch. And so that often ends up in fragmentation of that larger property into something that over a couple generations is going to turn into a non-viable farm size. So what an easement can do, as Jerome was saying, is sort of instead of selling off pieces of your land, you fragment off rights to all of your land and sell those and receive cash liquidity from your land without actually having to sell your land and while still being able to use it into the future. So this is a tool that can integrate into succession planning, which is especially difficult for farmers and ranchers.
Co-Chair Witt, we had Nellie come and speak at one of our quarterly meetings. She did an outstanding job. And one of our ranchers, who is one of our leaders in Baker County, for instance, said, we would really like to have her come out. So she came out and spoke. A big crowd that was there and very receptive of what she had to say. And a lot of these folks aren't real excited about the idea of paying $400 to $500 an hour for an attorney that they feel like is probably just going to be way overcharging them for a long period of time. So they want to know some of the basics out there. And so she was really able to lay out really what you need to kind of get done. Now, you're going to need to go to a lawyer to get this done, but this is kind of the basic structure and the education. I mean, we have folks that are in their 80s and they have never talked to their kids about succession planning, and then the ranch isn't there anymore. And so is this actually writing the succession plans for an individual farm? No, it's an education process.
Thank you very much. That's an interesting perspective. Thank you. Anyone else? Panel members, I want to thank you very, very much. I know that each of you have put a lot of time into this, and I don't always see the three of you testifying on the same side. And it's wonderful to see it happening. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chair Witt.
I'd like to call up next, please, Jim Myron and Jody Weiser. Good afternoon and welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you for allowing us the chance to talk. So I want to say that my chief thing I have to say is that everything this plan is going to do is being done. You heard, for instance, that they did 38 sessions of planning this year without the state putting in money to help pay for it. And if you start the program that the bill envisions, you're starting the planning process for something. And once the planning process is started, then they're back and they're asking for money to maintain it and to help finance the land trusts. We have multiple land trusts, and we have a number of different places that farmers can go and ranchers can go for help with thinking through the process of how they want to pass their assets on.
Jody, so, if I might interrupt, please, would you introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Jody Weiser, and I represent Tax Fairness Oregon.
Thank you.
So there are four main points I want to make. The first is we have existing a large number of supports for this agricultural sector. If you look at my testimony, we came up with over $550 million worth of ways we are supporting the industry this coming session. I actually don't remember my own words here. It's the cost in 2017, 2019, according to the tax expenditure report and other sources of things we're already doing for the industry. And we saw 18 different bills this session that would help this industry. And that's not looking at things like the cider bills, which would in some ways, but not directly. And so the question is, what if you want to add new things, what do you want to stop doing? Because we can't just keep layering one thing on after another and continue that kind of growth in expenditures. The second thing is succession planning. There's already what you heard Nellie talk about, her 38 sessions this year. There's the Austin Family Business Program at OSU. There's Family Business 360. There's the National Center for Employee Ownership and the Oregon Small Business Development Center Network. They're all offering help for thinking through the process of succession planning for this industry. And so it's not like the resources don't exist. Since I come from a farm family, I agree farmers tend to not talk about money very openly. And when they get serious about retiring, they get around to the succession planning because they realize it's going to be part of it. And if you're not ready to retire, you tend to have a hard time getting yourself to go. I think the only time I ever saw my father be nervous was when he went to pay for lawyers at a firm that would be Stoll Reeves. This was in California, but it was, you know, the biggest firm in the state. And I saw him feel uncomfortable with that. But that is a fact of their life. It's not a fact of public life. It's not a, it's not something that, that school children and foster care children and people who are facing bankruptcy with their homes, you know, should lose out on because there is a reticence on the part of farmers and ranchers to do their estate planning. It's not the responsibility of the state to pick up that that role. The third concern is we're really looking at funding for a group of nonprofits. They exist. They're doing land trusts now. So what's the problem that the bill is, will eventually address when they've got everything planned and they come back to you for more funding? And the third is just plain budget concerns. We don't have enough money. We don't have enough money to do what we're currently doing, so we need to be very careful when we set ourselves up to increase how we're spending money in the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jim, welcome.
Thank you. Co-chairs and members of the subcommittee, my name is Jim Myron, and I'm part of the loyal opposition to this bill here today representing Willamette Riverkeeper, the Deschutes River Alliance, the Conservation Angler, and Northwest Environmental Advocates. Online is our testimony as well as a section-by-section analysis of the bill that we actually did this about 3 months ago. The bill hasn't changed, so all I did was resubmit our previous submissions to the House Committee. The bill had one hearing in the House Committee and was sent down here. So if it moves, it'll move without having a hearing over on the Senate side, which is unfortunate, but that's the way things work around here sometimes. I'm not going to get into the details. I'm hoping that before you vote on this bill, you will read what we've provided to you, and it's the same thing we've been sending to you for the last 3 months. The concern is, and we tried to reach out to the proponents of the bill. We did meet with the land trust people before the House hearing, and it was pretty clear that they weren't interested in having any kind of conversations about potential amendments to the bill. About a month ago, I reached out again to a few of them, and the answer was basically the same. So we have to be continually opposed to the bill because there's not a lot of good that we can see in the bill as it's written. And the idea that $190,000 would pay for getting the thing up and running and paying for the rule writing, keep in mind that you're establishing a new fund that will eventually try to be funded by the public. You're establishing a new commission to make decisions over how this public money is spent for various projects. This commission is basically controlled and operated by the landowners. So it's not like an OWEB situation where you've got broad public representation. So that's just some of the concerns we have. And in the interest of time, I'll leave it at that and be happy to try and answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Comments for this panel? I'm not seeing any. Thank you both very, very much. So that I can plan on time management here, I have Ivan up next. I think I have Director Lufsgaarden after that. Was there anyone else who wishes to testify today on House Bill 3249? I'll make a final call before we close the hearing. Welcome, Ivan.
Chairs Frederick, Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Malusky, Policy Director with Friends of Family Farmers, based here in Salem. And it is with some mixed feelings that we testify on this bill today because there are some core elements that we actually support quite a bit and some elements that we really think need to be removed before it moves forward and before you take a vote on it. So I wanted to flag some of these issues for you and to kind of note that we have been very involved in these issues over the years in terms of next generation beginning farmer types of issues. Our organization started the Oregon FarmLink program, which is an online program that helps connect landowners with land seekers, folks who are looking to, who have land that are retiring, that are looking for, that maybe don't have a family member willing to take it over, can find people who are young and up and coming farmers looking to lease or purchase land. So we've been helping facilitate some of these connections since 2009. We also helped lead, and many of you are co-sponsors on the Aggie Bonds bill to create the Beginning Farmer Loan Program here in Oregon. And that does not actually loan state money out, but it does create an interest rate reduction program using the state's bonding authority to help address affordability issues. And that's a real concern of ours, is access to affordable land is sort of a key question. It's something that's come up in listening sessions that we've done over the years. We do need to create additional tools to provide affordable access to land. The Aggie Bonds program was one of those. We also supported a bill earlier this year that did not gain traction, unfortunately, for a beginning farmer tax credit, which would actually provide some tax incentives. It was in the news recently, it passed in Minnesota, but would actually encourage, through tax credits, either selling or leasing of land to beginning farmers. So we're looking at, there are a lot of creative ways, I think, to address some of these beginning farmer types of issues in land succession. Now, in terms of this bill, we actually support a number of the tools. We support enhanced use of working lands easements, and we support assistance with succession planning. The question of how much public funding should go to that, I think, is certainly an open one. But one of the pieces that we do not support in this bill is the creation of the commission, the Agricultural Heritage Commission. We think it's an unnecessary level of bureaucracy. It's costly. It's authorized in the bill to take up to utilize up to 12% of any money that the legislature or other sources authorize for the program every biennium. We agree there is a crisis and there's an urgent need. Unfortunately, this bill does not directly address the need in the near term. If the bill were amended to actually fund some grants on a pilot project type basis over the next 2 years or 4 years, that would be much more, we think, a better approach, and learn the lessons and look at setting up any longer term structures after we've learned some lessons and tested the theory, so to speak. So we would propose that essentially, and I'll back up 1 second and say nothing in this bill really directly addresses this question of affordability that we're very interested in. So land prices are rising very rapidly. It's very difficult for younger folks to get involved in farming these days, to purchase land in particular. You see increasingly farmland investors buying land. I don't know if the threat is so much from development in all cases, but oftentimes from out-of-state investors who can pay twice what the price is, what the going rate is. I don't see anything in this bill that gives me hope that we're necessarily going to address that question. I think, from my experience in the legislature, if you intend to address a specific problem, you need to call that specific problem out and build in some tools to address it. I think this bill sort of hopes that the commission itself will at some point address those. We're just not so sure, and we'd rather see something that more directly calls out questions around farmland affordability and how to address and taking on that more directly. So we would suggest simply deleting sections 7 through 10 of the bill in section 12, and then other references to the commission itself, and just restructuring this as a pilot project that's either 2 or 4 years long, or perhaps even 5 years, which would be a good number because it would coincide with the 2018 Farm Bill, and it would allow us to really test the theory of, are we leaving federal dollars on the table or not? We could look at it in the context of a 5-year federal farm bill and then revisit and say, did we achieve the goals we wanted? This is the kind of program that I think some of it is in the eye of the beholder. I think people are seeing things in this program that they want to see. I think there's a lot of potential for good. There's also potential for not so great things to happen with public dollars. And so So let's test the theory in a pilot project type basis, and then use a rules advisory committee, which I think would be, again, more affordable to the state, as opposed to creating this new permanent commission, which I think is the biggest thing this bill does, is create a permanent new commission that's going to require at least about $90,000 a biennium just to maintain itself in the long term. So then lastly, I'll conclude, say the dash twos, from what I can tell, really just add an emergency clause. And so they move the process of setting up the commission and the rulemaking more quickly. Unfortunately, despite declaring the bill an emergency, it does not appear that any grant funds would be made available in the near term. So, again, that's one of our core concerns. We could support this if we were actually doing some grant funding in the next 2 years. We're going to have to come back in the legislature in the future to seek more funding, apparently, for this if it goes through as currently written. So thanks for your time and hearing our testimony.
Thank you. We appreciate for your testimony. Questions for Ivan? I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Next, I'd like to call up Director Lustgarten, please. And again, if there's anyone else that wishes to testify, just raise your hand. Good afternoon and welcome.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Witt and Frederick, members of the committee. For the record, Maida Lofsgaarden, Executive Director with Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. While the governor's office is neutral on this proposal, I do want to just provide some information about how the program would fit and work with OWIB's funding, and I'm happy to answer any questions that the members of the committee might have about the program. I do want to take just a minute and extend my thanks to the work group as well. Just by way of background, OWIB actually funded the work group as a part of a governor's priorities process. So there was state funding in the development of the initial work group. And I can tell you, as Mr. Rosa said, it was an incredibly extensive and detailed process, including a lot of looking at other states. So Oregon is a little bit unique in that we don't have a program like this already. I think there's been a belief that Senate Bill 100 kind of protected farmlands, that our land use laws would take care of those. I think what the work group was really looking at is that really hasn't necessarily been the case, and how could we fill the gaps in a way that is uniquely Oregon. By way of background, the program is very compatible with the work that OWEB already does. We already do easement and acquisition programs. We already provide grant funding. We work with land trusts, soil and water conservation districts, and watershed councils, which makes it actually a fairly affordable program to administer once those rules are complete. We already have the structure and the infrastructure in place, so the program can be administered with very few additional resources. The question has come up about, while the program is compatible with OEB's existing programs, it can't be administered with Measure 76 funds. And I just wanted to lay that out so that you all understand the challenge. There are a variety of federal funding sources, as was noted, available for working lands, but they don't directly match up with OEB's funding, which is very much focused specifically on native fish and wildlife habitat and water quality. This program was really designed around that dual benefit of ensuring a strong agriculture economy and strong conservation benefits. And so while there are times that OWEB funds working land easements, it's really when the property is might have a small working land use, but it's probably not a primary income for the landowner. And so our funding just hasn't been really compatible with what the goals of this program are. We do work a lot with farmers and ranchers, but again, often the working portion of the farmer ranch doesn't qualify for Measure 76 funds, while the habitat portion does. So you end up leaving agriculture and that rural economy a little bit out of the equation in the way that Measure 76 funds are set up. It does also include a very strong emphasis on management planning to address all conservation opportunities on the ranch. That's soil, water, air, plants, animals, and the agriculture operation. These are really complex plans, and again, not something that OWEB traditionally funds. So this actually goes a little bit beyond the traditional work that OWEB does. Just by way of summary, it is a very uniquely Oregon program. It was designed in the legislation to fit in with OWEB's existing structure, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Subcommittee members? Maida, I was wondering if you could briefly describe some of the opportunities that this might present, this bill, in terms of conservation.
Yeah, Co-Chair Witt, thank you for the question. I'll give an example of a rancher in eastern Oregon who is smack in the middle of sage-grouse country. He has a sage-grouse breeding grounds on his land, has been working incredibly closely with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, NRCS, and others. He has a strong preference to keep that land in agriculture production permanently. He does not have children to transfer that land to. So the possibility of selling it could be sold to an investment company. This is right outside of an area that probably wouldn't be a subdivision, but could easily be broken into those 2,000-acre ranchettes that were discussed earlier. So in that case, the goal of the landowner is to keep that land permanently in agriculture production, to buy out the development rights for the property, which there are development rights for that property, which lowers the value of the property for the future landowner. So the current landowner receives the value for the development rights that he would receive later at sale if he was selling for development. The land value is lowered so a beginning farmer rancher might be able to more afford to come in. From the working lands perspective, this is about a 10,000-acre ranch. It is sustaining a family ranch. From the conservation perspective, it is smack in the middle of the Baker Lick area and one of the most important habitat areas for sage grouse.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? Not seeing anyone. Ada, thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate your appearance. Last and final call for the public testimony on House Bill 3249. Going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3249 and open a work session on House Bill 3249. And we have an amendment.
Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee, we have a proposed Dash 2 amendment, which includes $190,000 of general fund appropriation to OWEB to carry out the provisions of the bill.
Thank you very much. Subcommittee members, any questions before I recognize Co-Chair Frederick? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, I've been thinking about this on the C2 ranch, and there was something in the back of my mind that there was something there that was a benefit, I thought, to the whole Southern Oregon area. And that and then it dawned on me when we were talking about fish and what it has to do with elk and deer, I don't know. But it is a wintering ground for elk and deer in the whole general area. And that's why they're preserving it, if my memory serves me correct. I didn't get that when we had the conversation, but I think this is a seed money to start something here that we need to let it kind of go and see what it is, how it develops.
Thank you, Representative Esquivel.
Ducks Unlimited are very much in back of this, by the way.
Oh, very good. Thank you. Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very conflicted about this bill, and here's why. I have read carefully the March 14th letter and attachment from the organizations that Mr. Myron mentioned to us here, and I'm greatly concerned that about the points that are raised there and the potential for a program not to fulfill some of our goals, particularly toward the restoration of critical habitat for salmon and steelhead, particularly in our coastal areas. They've poked some holes potentially in a structure that would be used to preserve these working lands, which is great, but it could go terribly awry if we don't watch it carefully. On the other hand, I had a great experience late last year in Southern Oregon touring a couple of ranches, or one ranch, and then being able to view another ranch on the southern coast in Curry County. And one of these ranches is being run exquisitely. It is a sustainable operation in which the family is actually building coho habitat, and they're doing this voluntarily and on their own. They're able to do that. Right across the river is another piece of land that has been under litigation and was sold to a golf course developer. Now, that golf course may end up being wonderful for the fish habitat over there. I certainly hope so. They say they want to, and I'm all for that. But that doesn't necessarily always occur. And I've been part of these sort of land disputes in Southern Oregon in the past where big developers that are speculating on land dangle the possibility of big money in front of these old farming families where grandma and grandpa are really getting old. And they're getting up against the wall of having to make decisions. And that prospect of big money starts to change their mind about what they really want to do. And sometimes those developments pan out, and other times they don't, leaving the family worse off than before this money was dangled in front of their their eyes. And that's happening because there's no real concerted, organized effort to reach out to these families in an organized way with help that says, we, you know, yes, there are pieces, parts going on, but if, and the land trusts can do some things, and the other agencies and nonprofits that we have can help, but we're still getting these lands fall through the safety net, and they are being sold, and that is the worst thing that can happen, the worst. So on the one hand, I agree with Ms. Weiser, I agree with Mr. Myron. We're already doing a lot. I question a little bit about how about the efficacy of setting up yet another commission in this state. And I wonder and worry about a program that could go awry. But in the end, I think I'm going to have to be a yes on this request, because what we're doing now isn't working as well as it should. And with all of that said, I'm a sponsor of this bill. I'm not a chief sponsor, but I signed on early because I thought it was a pretty good idea. But I'll be watching this carefully as I continue my work at the legislature to make sure that as we move into that program and we start developing rules and we start seeing how this is going to work, that the commitment to building adequate habitat for our recovering salmonid species is there. It has to be there. So I think there's good intentions in the room and good intentions behind the bill, but I'll be watching to make sure that happens. And if it doesn't, then I'll be leading a group to make changes. Thank you for allowing me to make that statement, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Helm. And I think you've brought up some very important points. It would be my hope, and I think the program is designed in this manner, that the commission will be intimately involved in helping design the structure upon which the planning takes place. And it would be my hope that that would mitigate against the land grab, the shysters, the less than upfront conservation-minded approach to preservation and avoidance of fragmentation, but rather that it be kept whole in the interests of conservation and other values as well. So, additional discussion, Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little bit conflicted on this one as well, and I think I would have preferred to see it a pilot project, as was discussed. On the other hand, I'm from an agricultural district, and I know that there are challenges with farmers and succession planning. I think that piece of it is important. I'm not crazy about a $190,000 general fund expenditure when we're trying to balance a budget, but I'd like to see where this thing moves from this point, so I think I'll be a yes on this one.
Thank you very much. Any other comments, discussion? Co-Chair Frederick, on the -2 amendment.
Co-Chair Witt, I move the -2 amendment for House Bill 3249.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Frederick moves the -2 amendment to House Bill 3249. Discussion on his motion? Seeing none, is there any objection to his motion? Seeing none, it's adopted. Thank you very much. Again, Co-Chair Frederick.
Co-Chair Witt, I move House Bill 3249 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Frederick moves House Bill 3249 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on his motion? I am not seeing any. Would you, clerk, please call the roll?
Yes.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Senator Frederick?
Yes.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Helm?
Aye.
Representative Power?
Aye.
Representative Lewis?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye. Motion having received the necessary majority passes. Subcommittee members, thank you very much. It was great discussion on these issues. Senator Frederick will carry. And I think Representative Bueller has expressed an interest in carrying on the House side as well. So with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3249. Thank you all very, very much.
Senator who's